This is Dennis Wilkins, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 3rd of May 2012. Dennis Wilkins, Part 2.
Yeah, so we're talking about the period of you know, before going south and I was doing the senior house office jobs. And as I say, you've got experience, but you're chiefly you were there to be an assistant and to do your theory and get the exam. Because without that exam, you didn't go any further, really. And happy days. I did the orthopaedics. It was an interesting hospital in the sense that it was down in the docks in the Liverpool. And the most famous orthopaedic forefather in this country is a chap called Robert Jones. And he was a Liverpool surgeon. And he that was where he did his work. Back in the heroic age of surgery in the
turn of the century,
in the 1900s and, you know, First World War time and that sort of thing. So I worked on his Robert Jones wards and there was Robert Jones there. And it was a great hospital. I learned a lot. Good surgeons and a happy place. And very, we did casualty, we did accident emergency work between 5 o'clock at night and 8 the following morning. And I mean, the standards then were different. You know, I mean, here we were juniors who just actually out of medical school giving anaesthetics and setting bones and doing all that sort of thing. And I think we did all right. But, of course, it would be a completely different standard. Now, you take several years after qualification before you're really allowed to do anything independently.
Were you learning dentistry as well?
Yes, I did. I did a session at the in the dental school. We had a good dental school there, but I didn't do perhaps as much as I should have done. The thing about this was that the medical cover in those days was in its infancy. I think the hierarchy of BAS expected, not unreasonably, that a doctor was a doctor and would do everything a doctor would do, and the idea of expedition medicine as a specialty and formal training programs to go out there was just not thought about. Why? I don't know, but it's difficult to put yourself into those sorts of mindsets. Maybe there wasn't the time, and maybe there wasn't the edit. But we contrived, being sensible people, to get as much training as we could, and we went down fairly well equipped. Eyes were something that worried me, and so I went and did some time at the eye infirmary. But by and large, one went down and just thought, well, we'll get on with it.
And they train you about dealing with the Antarctic as such? How to get out of a crevasse?
No. You were trained when you got down there for that sort of thing. You know, in the terms of the general assistants would, you know, you say, well, I don't know anything about this. Other guys would say, I'm an experienced mountaineer and I can do this, isn't it? And it was that sort of ethos. Very, what's the word for it? Very ad hoc. Mm. But it worked. It worked in that they, you know, we practiced that sort of thing and showed it. But I guess we weren't really very competent. We weren't really competent looking back on it.
Were you confident when you set foot on the Perla Dam?
Confident. No. Considerable trepidation, I would say. Considerable trepidation. I mean, you know, young doctors. And you, as a doctor, you see, you're expected to be, if you like, an elder. And I don't know whether it's still the case, but, you know, you're looked up to in that sense. You're not the leader, you're not the boss, but you're somewhere between the two. You're looked up by the chaps, somebody they can confide with. You have a special role as a doctor anywhere, but, you know, in this sort of setting as well. You're looked to by the boss, the leader, whoever it may be, as a support for him or her as well. And that was the sort of position that someone like Edward Wilson had, interestingly, in the Scott setup. If you look at the doctors in the polar firmament, the heroic age and the rest of it, that was always the position. And sometimes, and one of the doctors in one of the medical reports I was looking at a while back mentioned that. He said it's a very difficult position to tread because you mustn't be seen or, in fact, to challenge in the leadership side of things. That's not you. And yet you've got to be supportive, and yet the chaps will come to you and say, what about this, and advice and so forth. So you have to sort of be one of them for most of the time, all of the time, and pitch in, do your bit, rest of it and so forth. And yet there's a compartment which puts you in a different category, and you don't really have anybody to talk to about that sort of thing. You can talk a bit to the base commander, but you really don't, you know, there's confidences which are given and which have to be retained. And that's I think most medics, I don't know what somebody like Terry and the others would say, but most medics, I think, found it a really important learning experience down in the Antarctic to tread that path and become competent. It was a growing experience.
I found that also in the interviews I've been doing. I interviewed a doctor who'd been there just a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And that doctor has also spent some time talking about one's position, maintaining the distance and the closeness at the same time.
Yes.
And was it trial and error, or did you have a policy?
It was just trial and error. You sort of thought about it, and you realised, and you had to be careful to keep a clasp on your tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Strong alcohol can be a terrible thing. So you just have to. I think you just learn, and it's I guess some people did it better than others. I don't know. It's not for me to judge how well or otherwise I did it, but one coped. But you see, the privacy was. I mean, if there was something happening, there was no patient confidentiality in many respects. I mean, if you were taking a tooth out or you're doing or filling with that, they expected to be there with the cameras, and you know, and I mean, the patient obviously had to give their permission, and you had control of it. But they would say, I remember one occasion, you know, do you want this? Oh yes, please. Yeah, come on, chaps. Yeah, so it was all a bit odd. But then, of course, there are other times when it's just absolutely not. You just get on with it. It's not a public spectacle.
The other thing which doctors have almost uniquely to them was the fact that they actually had plenty of spare time, because the last thing you were doing as a doctor on base was doctoring.
Yes.
So you were able to get muck in a lot more than other scientists or other professionals.
And that was terrific. That was terrific.
So what was the benefits of that for you?
Physical work, getting to know people, learn a few new skills, mostly about shoveling snow, and you got the opportunity to do a bit in the workshop if you wanted it. But the spare time that I had, I found a unique opportunity to read. I read the whole of Churchill's Second World War, all 12 volumes, Gibbon's Decline and Fall, and a couple of other sort of serious works, because you had the time actually to do it, and it was very good. But it wasn't unique to me. I mean, everybody would do that sort of thing, and you'd discover, and again, it comes back to this business of didn't matter what your background was, you actually could participate at the same level, and you'd get Diesel Mech having read The Decline and Fall and discussing it with some erudition, with, you know, a classicist or somebody else who was down there. So it was good, you know, it was very, very good. So reading was something I did. Learning the skiing and all that technique, going to study the penguins if there was field trips to go and look at things, other scientific programs, participate in cartography and that sort of stuff, meteorology, chores. So no, I mean, you were a general odd body. I don't know whether the other doctors have found the same, Terence and Terry Allen and people like that, but it was a benefit, I thought.
So you got out a fair bit, partly because of this plan you'd concocted for yourself, but also being a doctor, you were in charge of the welfare of the huskies.
Yes, and that was a big part. We had about 68 huskies, and so one of the things I did was construct a breeding tree. So I did
first
that
time
that
had been
huskies.
Done.
Yeah. I think so. I don't know, but I think it was. And it was down there, certainly in Halley Bay, when we set up the medical unit here. One of the doctors here said, Jonathan Paddle, I think it was, said, oh, it's still down there. It was, you know, on a wall somewhere. So that was quite good. And I think that was helpful to the dog handlers, the general, the GA people, because it crystallised where you were likely to get inbreeding and problems, which, of course, you couldn't avoid. But actually, it sort of enabled you to make a more intelligent choice of mating and that.
So when you arrived, were you observing inbred dogs?
No, but I was well aware of it because Andrew Bellars, who was the advisory vet and who I met not fairly recently, he had written some very good notes which told you the things to look out for, the dysplastic hips, entropion, and the eyes, you know, turning and all this sort of thing. So we were well aware of the sorts of things to look for. And yes, there was over the year some problems in that direction. But mostly it was just general veterinary and old dogs needing to be put down. And we had this stuff, pentobarbital. Anyway, it was a barbiturate. No, it wasn't pentothal, but it was a barbiturate of some sort. Anyway, Expiral, you know, I mean, a wonderful name, isn't it, for putting these poor creatures down.
So they just ate it and...
No, you injected it and... there again, you see, you learned what fantastic coats these animals had. You know, it was just like duffel, the inner layers of fur. You must have seen this maybe when you were down there. Terrific animals. So you learned how to inject, how to intubate, anaesthetise, and all the rest of it. And, of course, surgical skills were very useful, you know, because they had some horrendous injuries. And you know, if they were, you know, things got out of hand, they would really... hack each other to death, really. But so it was probably the most active part of the job, actually, looking after the dogs.
Were you also playing midwife?
Yeah, to a degree, but the dog handlers did all that. But I didn't have any serious obstetric problems. They just got on with it. I think there was one pup where the bit rolled over on it, and another bitch got hold of it and chewed it to bits. I think it was April she got hold of this poor newly born pup, and before anybody realised it, given it a going over, and it died. But it's mauling. But by and large, the obstetric side of things, they just gone on and did it. Terrific, terrific animals. And it was, I mean, what a privilege to be able to run your own dog team. We had my dog team was the Hairy Breeks, and you know, it was the cripples, old men, and misfits, but they were just wonderful. And Harry Wiggins had taught me how to run them, and I went out with Genghis Wright as well. He was in my set, and we learned together. And we sort of got by with these dogs and made them run, but some people never did. And there was one chap who went out with the dogs for his first run in the winter, and you just watched him going around the horizon, you know, with the dogs, and they wouldn't do what he wanted. But others were natural at it, and just they, you know, got them going.
When it came to having to put the dog down, how was that decided? Who would do it? Was that always your job?
Always me.
Never the dog handler.
No,
choosing.
No, it was me. But he would, you know, say, "What about this?" And we'd make the decision together, and do it. And the important thing was that it was done properly without any, you know, without any fuss. Mm. So you learned how to find the right vein to inject it and how to control a dog, which was useful for later life when you were, you know, trying to do something to a dog, how to keep it under control without hurting it or doing too much hassle.
Where were you going on these stretching trips?
Well, the role, and Pete Clarkson was the base commander, and the role we worked out really was that where I could be useful, as well as fulfilling my sort of agenda, was to go route surveying and taking Fids out for a holiday. Because, you know, here were these guys sat on the base. How much chance did a cook get to go off base? How much chance did a physicist get off? So if they wanted a short trip, and you could combine it with after winter with reconnoitering a a route and to see that it was still safe, see what had happened. Then off you went. And we had one or two, you know, really good adventures where we'd go and survey a route which sometime previously had been quite secure and the rest of it, and we'd find, you know, sucking great chasms there. And one time we found ourselves on a large spur peninsula which was about to go out, you know. It's a great crack opening up across its base, and yeah, sure enough, it went out as an iceberg not too long afterwards. So there were some, you know, it was marginally useful. And
that was a near miss, was it?
Yeah.
Were you camped at the time? When?
What happened was, as I recall, that we had to call in every night with a radio schedule, and our radio set didn't work, so or packed up or something. So there we were, having gone up north, I think it was, and we were kind of about 15 miles up this peninsula of ice, with a view to getting off it, and there was a route there, and then on the sea ice, and then going further up. So I guess the base commander, having been concerned that we hadn't actually hadn't heard from us, had said to one of the other sledges that was out not too far away, just go up and check on Wilkes and his thing, because they should be there. And so suddenly these people appeared at the end of the day, as it were, which is great, and we camped together and so forth. And they said, you've got a remarkable dog team there. I said, why? They said, well, where your dog tracks were crossing over the base of the peninsula is, you know, 10 feet, 12 feet or whatever. That's a pretty big leap. And then, so, well, that's all right. It'll be okay for a while, because it's quite a, you know, several miles. And then the next day they went off, and on the radio schedule next, they said, you better get off that bit of ice. They said, because where it was 10 feet before, it's now 30 or 40 feet. Go. So I lay in bed there for a bit, and then I thought, no, I don't like this. So it was pretty much daylight all the time. So we just packed up and pushed off, and it really had altered. We had to go quite a bit far west to get across the onto the ice shelf again. So that was an interesting time. I remember it being a bit worrying.
What would have happened if you hadn't been able to cross the chasm?
I don't know. I don't know. I guess we'd have managed somehow, but it was. But the worry was that we wouldn't, and we'd go out on an iceberg somewhere. Because remember, there were famous case in Halley when the whole team, dog team, and a chap were lost under those sorts of circumstances. So that figured in our mind, and you knew it could happen. They went off and were never seen again. You know, very lonely, terrible way to die. Because you didn't have the communications in those days, and there was no way of getting down there for rescue parties and planes and so forth.
Was that the only near miss, or were there others?
No, for me, I mean, no, not really. I mean, there's the routine stuff. You got used to it in the end. You've got, you know, the crevasses and so forth, and snow bridges giving way after you've been over them, that sort of thing. But I don't know. There was one time when we were sledging in Whiteout, and it was with Graunch, as he was called, and it was Whiteout, and the sledge started to go away, so we stopped, and we thought, that's just stupid. Because, again, there'd been accidents with Whiteout. And we camped. And when the sun broke through, there was a huge, huge crevasse and chasm, you know, in the direction that we would have been going. And it wasn't that far. And I've got a nice slide of Graunch looking over it, and a before and after picture, you know. That was impressive.
Can you recall Graunch's real name?
No,
okay, it doesn't matter. Okay.
I could have given time, but he's a lovely chap. He's a good chap. He was a met man.
How much doctor work did he actually do on human beings?
Well, we had a fair amount of sprains and minor injuries and fractured fingers and so forth. Dental work, a few eyes, nothing serious. And it was that sort of level. And we didn't have any coughs and colds. The coughs and colds tended to die out after about 6 weeks. I think that was the common experience, once you're isolated and the ship had gone. Occasional attack of D&V.
D&V?
Diarrhea and vomiting.
Oh, right.
I have to say I haven't...
Is that from food?
Well, water probably, because you were... we cleared out the water tanks when I was there once, and your job when you were on GASH, on duty to do the looking after the cooking and chores in the base, you went out and you shoveled snow into the tank, into these melt tanks for the day, and they would gradually melt, and that was the supply of cold water. So we thought we'd clear those tanks out, and we found a good mountain of dog turds and a seal's head. So it was all sorts went in there, unbeknown. By and large, they were pretty healthy, but there was the odd attack of diarrhea, and I guess that's where it came from, that sort of thing.
The big challenge, of course, was the appendix operation, and let me mention the patient's name to save you having to do it. It was Johnny Carter, the diesel electric mechanic.
Yeah.
You'd had yours taken out. He obviously hadn't.
Yeah.
How did that situation arise? When were you first aware of it?
Well, he just called to his cabin because Johnny hadn't appeared and was feeling a bit crook. And went along and got bellyache, and you felt with sinking heart, tenderness over the right eye. This can't be happening. This can't be true. But he was tender there, and you waited 24 hours, and it got worse. And there you were stuck, and it was during the winter. And you thought, what would I do if I was in civilization? Would I just give him antibiotics and just hope for the best and hope it'll settle? And I knew enough to know that if appendicitis is neglected, 60% of them will get better, 60-65%. But a lot of them won't, and some of those will die. This is why appendicectomy came about. And so it was a bit of a facer, really, but it wasn't getting better. And so I thought, got to do it. And I just, I'd have done anything not to have had to do it. Really wasn't. But Johnny was very brave, I have to say. He just said, all right, Doc, get on with it. And I went and saw Rocky and all the rest of it and so forth. And we telexed
Rocky.
Base. That's Pete Clarkson. And he said, yeah, right. I trained up a medical assistant, Bob, and he was a physicist. And so the two of us, with the team, operating team, if you like, and as I recall, it was Pete Clarkson who gave the anaesthetic. We had this machine called the PJ Nunn anaesthetic machine, which was a very primitive but effective piece of kit. And we set it up in the doctor's surgery and just got on with it. And it wasn't a very elegant piece of surgery in the sense that the anaesthetic, he was either climbing off the table or was lying there lifeless, not breathing, but he was a strong lad and he came through it in the end, all right. And then afterwards, it all went okay. And after, it was appendicitis. And afterwards, he just, you watched him with bated breath, he's going to be all right. But he was. He was a strong Yorkshire lad and no problems.
Were you having to amend with equipment? You needed an operating table, didn't you, for a start?
Yeah, we just used the couch, the examinations couch. And we had instruments there. Not a huge bunch of them, but we had enough. There was contingency planned. Murray Roberts had been the medic before, and he'd put in a very comprehensive order for equipment. And that was a good piece of work. So,
and that had arrived at it, unusually.
Yeah, it came down with us, you see, so that was important. Because if the guy didn't do that, we would have been a bit stuffed. I can't remember how much we had and how much came down, but I know in general terms Murray Roberts was responsible for a great improvement in the amount of stuff that was down there. And Johnny made an uneventful recovery. I think he always said that, you know, he had to wear high neck sweaters to cover the scar, but he was pretty phlegmatic about it, and he was good, no problem. Yeah, great guy.
What was the fate of the offending
organ?
Organ, yeah.
It was put into some sort of solution, and I wanted to take it back and get it looked at, but I don't ever recall that. I mean, when we looked through the stuff that came back, I don't ever recall that. I couldn't find it, and I don't know what happened to it, is the honest answer. But it was definitely taken out. I mean, of course it was, because everybody was there. But it was definitely put by in solution to come back with alcohol to preserve it. Mm. But it, you know, Lord knows what where it went in the end. But it wasn't there when we unpacked all the cases and everything to go. So maybe somebody had it, kept it as a souvenir, I don't know. But it would have been nice. But it was appendicitis, it was inflamed and horrible.
Did you have any frostbite cases to do with?
Yes, had a few. The carpenter was the guy, that was Ron James. He was a Scouse, and he got some frost nip of his fingers, which took a bit of time to heal up, and we got quite a lot of blistering and that sort of thing, but nothing serious where anybody actually lost a digit. Certainly you've got frost nip and that sort of level. And it was an interesting thing, if you did get cold injury of a fingertip and it just came back, that fingertip remained quite sore and quite sensitive, and the sensation was never quite the same again afterwards. Hypothermia? No, not really.
How could frostbite happen? Because, you know, all the guys down there knew all about frostbite and they knew how to avoid it.
Well, the carpenter, you see, has got to be using his hands and handling cold metal, and I think he was building a tunnel or something like that, and you know, just got a little bit too cold for a while. But it wasn't a bad case, and it, you know, just sticks in my mind. So I don't. It wasn't, as you say, the people knew about it, and so it took great pains. But where people would have it continuously, and I don't know whether you noticed that when you were down there. On your cheeks, they were always peeling, and your nose and things like this, and that was sort of a form of cold injury or sun injury. We had a couple of cases of snow blindness as well, you know, watery eyes and that. I think I got a touch of it myself once, you know, people just not wearing their glasses, and that was uncomfortable, but it soon went away.
You were there for just about 12 months, 13 months. Mm. Were you over that time building up a picture of the what could be improved in the health service in the Antarctic?
Yes. Yes, I mean, you know, you realised that you needed more professional approach to the training and that sort of thing, and I think that was put in the report. The way of these things is of incremental improvements, but of course it has to be done within the confines of what economics would allow, you know, and the time that people could spend just getting trained up. But it did come to pass many years later that the opportunity arose to do something about that, because the contract for provision of medical services came up and we bid for it from Derriford.
You bid for it?
Yep. And
it was currently in Aberdeen, wasn't it? Historically, yeah, it was Aberdeen. Yeah.
So in a sense it wasn't our business to, you know, you could make recommendations at that time, but you weren't in a position to actually do much about it. And so we bid for it, and were fortunate enough to get it. And we didn't really, I mean, we two of us, Chris Andrews and myself, and we didn't really quite understand what it was they wanted. We were guessing at what they wanted. But in retrospect, and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, I think what Bass wanted was the comfort of a large DGH to supporting its activity. I mean, the powers that have been had seen that the medical side of things really wasn't safe, in you know, with the greatest respect to Nelson Norman and his teams up in Aberdeen, weren't really safe in a smaller unit where There wasn't full access to a range of specialists, care and the rest of it, and professional training. So the first bid we put in was fairly small bid, I forget how much for, but it was pretty limited and circumscribed. And, you know, during the process of iteration after, you know, this initial sifting had come out of the bidders, it became apparent they wanted much more. So we put in a much more comprehensive thing. And I think the clever thing that we did was to understand that the best model was as an outreach of the accident and emergency service. And that, once we realised that, we could then shape it. And
like it was like an annex,
you realize. Yes, yeah. Yes. I mean, extended line of communication. But those are the sorts of skills you need. You know, you've got, if in A&E, you've got to be a, well, you watch Holby City and all.
I don't all actually, but yeah, my wife does.
Yes, well, there we are. But, you know, you've got to be a complete doctor and have a knowledge of a lot of different specialties. But you've really got to be able to deal with trauma as well, which is the big thing. So we worked out that was the thing to do. And then it was a Christmas time. We needed a medical director, we reckoned, somebody who would really take hold of it and put the work in to get not just the contract shaped up, but actually to get to supervise the whole operation. And so we went to a chap called Ian Grant, who was an A&E consultant, a naval, ex-naval background, young chap, and said to him, Ian, we've got this here contract we're bidding for. Yes. and I explained it to him, and I said, would you be interested in being medical director? And he said, sounds interesting.
What was your position at that time?
I'm a surgeon in Derriford,
right,
at a hospital there, you know, getting on a bit there, you know, quite fairly senior surgeon for what it's worth. But nothing more than that. He said, when do you want to know? And I said, well, midday tomorrow is when we've got to get it in. And he came back the next day and he said, yep, I'll do it. And that involved him actually taking a great leap of faith, because he would then be employed by us, not directly. We'd set it up, and the managers, the chief executive was a chap called Wilson at the time. He was very supportive. And he said, yes, run it as a separate contract. And, you know, if the funding comes in, we'll do the employment and all the rest of it. But essentially, he's employed on that contract. And he then goes and does it all. And the other huge piece of fortune we had was there was an anaesthetist down here called Anna Weiss. And her husband, we found out surreptitiously, was a chap called Peter Marquis. And Pete, of course, is hugely respected and experienced base commander, explorer, and all the rest of it. And he was teaching in Plymouth and was eminently suitable for the role of being the manager of that contract. So we put a feeler out. He was hacked off, put it bluntly, with teaching in a sink school in Plymouth where, you know, despite his clear leadership skills and potential, it was being wasted. And so he said, yeah, I'll do that. And he's been with us ever since, over the 10 or 12 years since the contract has been running here.
Were you aware of the stink that that caused?
No. Did it cause a stink?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, particularly in Aberdeen.
Yes. Well, we never really had anything to do with that. I mean, we just bid as we would. Oh, go on, tell me about it then.
Well, perhaps afterwards, because it's not part of your experience. Yeah, but I'm happy to chat a bit. It's just from other interviews I've done.
So I hope I haven't said anything out of turn.
No, absolutely not.
Was from our perspective.
Yeah.
So it was an honest bid, and we were quite proud to get thing. And I think, I think it was a credit to the directors of BAS that they realised something had got to be done.
So what happened next then? You got the contract, and suddenly, of course, you had to fulfil it.
Yes. Yes, and that was down to Pete Marquis and Ian Grant, and they did it brilliantly. They did absolutely brilliantly. And how we ran it was that the folk, myself, Chris Andrews, and one or two other key people who were on board within the hospital, acted as, if you like, as a board of directors. I think that's probably a bit grand, but that's what it was. And so we would meet regularly and do what had to be done and, you know, any decisions that needed to be made. But Ian went into it and Pete went into it absolutely wholeheartedly, set up the programme for the training, the paramedics, the annual conference. We did all sorts of good work. I mean, they revamped Curafid. Curafid is the manual for the medics. They remodernised that, and it was a good book. John Brotherhood wrote the first edition of it. They modernised that, put it on a CD as well, kept it up to date, and just, I think, you know, went up, the standard went up terrifically. But the training was the thing. These guys, when they were appointed well ahead of the time, and they then did a programme in the hospital and outreach to give them the skills that they were likely to need, and it paid off.
Can you give examples of that, comparing it to the absolute absence of anything that you did really before you went south 40 years ago?
Well, they go round all the departments. First of all, they learn how to do the trauma. But most of the selection is interesting, because I sat on the initial selection panels, but it was quite clear that the best background was either anaesthetics or A&E, you know, people going from that sort of thing. But we took anybody, you know, who was, we felt was sufficiently right in the round. They were given a theoretical course on remote medicine, healthcare, anything from infectious diseases through to general medicine, you know, things they might get, ulcerative colitis, gallstones, pancreatitis, resuscitation, all the sorts of skills that you would need. The other thing that we that fitted, and it became apparent it would fit, was the contract for the pharmacy supplies. And we have a very, very big pharmaceutical department in the hospital, which was actually running about 50 or 60 contracts for external bodies, anything from doctor surgeries to you know, cooperatives and other sorts of organizations that needed regular skill. And the skill that they could bring was to make sure that the drugs that went out, first of all, were comprehensive, all the equipment was comprehensive, but that it was kept under review, so you didn't end up with a load of stuff like local anesthetic which was 10 years out of date. And that expertise really appealed to Bass, and that was taken on, and it worked. And as far as I know, it's still with them. Dentistry was a bit of a problem for us, in the sense that it wasn't ours. It was run from Peterborough by an RAF dentist who did it very well and went down and was peripatetic, and we were very happy with that. It wasn't, when I say it was a problem, it wasn't our bag, but we were sort of pushed into, you know, wanting to take that on. And I remember Pete was a bit reluctant, but now we've got a dental school. I think that really is not a problem, and I believe, since I left anyway, that it's now catered for. So you see, you know, it's funny, isn't it, how these things, from small beginnings, how these things sort of gel and, yeah, happen. Great.
It's to do with individuals with the right skills or experience being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, yeah.
I get the impression the doctors going south are still pretty young, are they?
Yes.
Is that on purpose, or is that just the way things pan out because later in career you can't really disturb your career path?
I don't think I can really answer that at the moment, but I know that you are hostage to the applicants you get. And I don't recall us getting applications from many people who are hugely elderly.
Are you still involved in the appointments of these?
No, not anymore. No, it's done by the personnel. Bass, with the help, you know, and the panel has the medical director sitting on it, and Pete Marquis and so forth, and they're pretty good at it. Mm. And by and large, the appointments, I think, have been pretty good.
What we're talking about, just for the record, is BASMU, isn't it?
Yeah.
British Antarctic Survey Medical Unit. Is that correct? Yeah. Are you aware of medical research work that's been done in the last few years, which has actually eventually filtered into everyday medical practice? Are you across all that?
No, I'm ignorant on that. I know that Ian Grant, one of the things he did was to take very active part in the international collaborative on Antarctic research through SCAR, And he built up some very good contacts and participated, entered in, you know, data and so forth, which our medics actually helped with in collecting data on things like SAD, you know, somatic afferent disorder and that sort of thing, and the psychology. I think the psychology profile of selection was another thing that I can't remember who was the lead investigator, but it was an international effort. So that's the way the research went. It was a collaborative, and you were doing, as research across the scientific community is, you know, it's different centres, and one's a lead and you utilise a huge, huge thing. But I'm not aware of how that has gone since then. I know that we always wanted money from the director of research at BASS, but we can never get any. You know, I don't think we were looked upon as being sufficiently clued up or glamorous to run a research program of our own. But I still think that that's something we should be doing as part of the contract. And I'll go on record as saying that.
Okay.
Yeah. And we've now got a degree in remote healthcare, which Anne Hicks, the current director, medical director, who took over from Ian Grant, who retired last year, she has worked throughout to get a degree going based on Plymouth University for remote healthcare, and that is working now. But the other thing, coming back to the profile, the benefit of actually having it based on a department was that although Ian Grant was the putative head of, you know, he was our medical director, all the other consultants, and there are five or six of them, were equally on board and interchangeable. So they all developed the expertise, and it became known that the department was running the British Antarctic Survey medical unit out there. And so we sent down over the years as a douceur, as a, if you like, a bonus, but also pragmatically, the consultants there on, you know, for a 6-week period during summer to go and suss out this or suss out that and report back that on what was happening. And I think that was an attractive, or that was a bit of payback for the work that they did. And out of any surplus that we could make from the contract, we put in place a series of or bids for grants, for small grants, for people within the hospital who would not normally have access to a small amount of DOSH to go and do a course, or to, you know, travelling expenses to go and do a course, this sort of thing. And so that is still running, as far as I'm aware, and is quite popular and is very helpful. So you see, the contract has helped the hospital, and the hospital has put in there. It's an ideal situation. I'm very, very proud of it. I think it's a terrific piece of kit, which, so, you know, the team has put in place.
What percentage of the hospital's overall activity would you say there was a BASS part? Was it 5%, 10% of what you...
Oh, no, tiny percent. Therford is one of the biggest three or four hospitals in Europe. I mean, it's huge. And so, on the scale of things, it's... But, I mean, it's a major part of the A&E department. You know, it's a major thrust or purpose of their work.
A doctor down south can ring up, can he,
yes,
or she?
Yes, yeah, and all the modern telemetering now. And don't push me on precisely what, but there is instant access pretty well to reading x-rays, investigations, expertise, specialist opinions in whatever area it is, from, you know, anaesthetics through to psychiatry, you know. So,
did you send yourself back down south again?
No, I had the opportunity, but no. I've been pretty busy as doing other things, and I've always really wanted to keep my memories intact. I don't know whether others have found this, but people who went back tended to whinge about, and I don't mean this unkindly, that, oh, in my day it was such and such, remember, rugged, it's all changed and the rest of it and so forth. I might go down and do a cruise sometime, but essentially I'd really rather keep my memories intact. Been there and done that, and I'm interested in the history, but actually going back down there again, yeah, maybe, but I made the decision, I wasn't, it was better that someone else went down there who would get more out of it. You know, these places are precious, aren't they, to go on that sort of trip, and you need to send someone who's going to be A, appreciate it, and B, is going to be a benefit to the cause.
The two main whinges seem to be, where's all the ice gone, and they're not really fids anymore.
Yes, I can imagine that that would be the sort of thing, and who wants somebody like that on a trip? Yeah.
When women started to go on a regular basis, that must have been a bit of a challenge for the medical teams, wasn't it?
Endless discussions.
Tell me about that.
Well, you're opening up a whole new range of pathology. Now, the human interactions are not our business, except marginally if there's any sort of fighting or whatever. It had to happen, I can see that. And fine, you know, they've been a compliment. But it does open up a whole range of other problems, from pregnancy through to women's disorders, you know, gynecology and so forth, obvious things. And it's a worry. You know, it was a worry, but it was catered for, managed, and it works.
So, Basmu now, if a woman were to get pregnant in the Antarctic, then Basmu might step in to guide?
Yes, I mean, if it was... yes, I mean, it would have to cope with that. Now, don't ask me about whether there have been any pregnancies which have caused a problem. I can't tell you. I don't know. I know that there have been occasions when people have come back pregnant, you know, so but you know, no more than that can I say.
No, I mean, the question, I suppose, one that's going through my mind is what would one do, or what would be done about a potential abortion down there?
Yeah, quite. It would have to be handled. I mean, part of the training. So the guys, you know, are trained. They have to do a gynecology slot. Do you see the thing? If you appoint somebody, you're not going to appoint somebody who is a complete Antarctic doctor. You're going to have to tailor the training program to what he or she has or has not on board. And obviously, if somebody's already an anaesthetist, you wouldn't want to send them on, you know, an anaesthetic module. So, you know, there's that sort of flexibility in the scheme for training. And I think that's a major consideration. But the other thing that was done, of course, was, and I think this is very popular, is in the BAS conference, the Cambridge conference, there are workshops on for the paramedics, and that's a very important part of the work of the BASMU, is providing that training, not just for the doctors, but for people who will be going out sledging, who will be in a position of some responsibility without immediate medical help. So the paramedic training is important.
You're training ordinary other professions in paramedic skills.
So every bod who goes out there, gets an exposure to common medical things, you know, the chats and the talks, and they will be taught about CPR, resting hemorrhage, the sort of thing that you would expect probably from a ship's captain, you know, somebody at sea, first aid. I'm involved with St John at the moment, and so they would get that sort of training, you know, for everybody who went down there. But also the paramedics, the ones who are likely to be in a position where they might be expected to do a bit more leadership, they would get more training.
What is still to be done in the medical management of the Antarctic? What challenges still exist for BASMU and BAS?
I think selection. They can work quite well with selection and that sort of thing.
You mean recruitment?
Recruitment, you know, and the profiling of folk.
Have you spotted that there are still inadequacies there?
Well, don't forget I'm out of date here, but I know that the research was ongoing about that. I mean, they get the occasional blip of somebody who's not quite fit, so there's always room for improvement there. What else? On the physical side, no, I think just to keep the level and standards, the scope and the standards of training and practice up with the doctors you send down, make sure you get the selection of doctors right. What more you can do about that, I don't really know. I think it's much, much more routine. You know, I mean, it's like all these things. They start off heroic, you know, like surgery. You know, Sir Lancelot Spratt, and it's all gung-ho, sweat on the brow and the rest of it. It's like the early aviators. they go off, you know, and it was all sort of, you know, scarf in the wind and we'll get through and maybe... But the way of things is that techniques evolve, it becomes much safer, refined and dull, routine, and that's how it should be because you've covered the bases, occasional moments of stress, as it were, but actually, by and large, if it's dull and professional, that seems to me to be how it should be.
I have to ask you a slightly dog-leg question. It's to do with being inventive about being a FID. Somebody who's FIDs or potential FIDs are people who can solve unusual problems with unlikely materials.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to ask you about your Riley car and the insulation of your Riley car.
The insulation?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. You've obviously been fed
I also was a Riley owner. I had a Riley. Were you? My first car was a Riley 1.5, former police pursuit car.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
That's good. No, no, it struck me one time that we put this orthopaedic felt with sticky backing on. It was used to line splints and that. And, you know, there was some of this lying around the place and it struck me as being eminently suitable to put on the inside of resonating panels, and it worked. And orthopaedic wool and so forth. Yeah, very good. Should have followed that up as a marketing opportunity. Another opportunity missed.
I think we've more or less got to the end of everything I wanted to ask you, unless you think I've missed something.
Nope. No, I think that's...
This is my usual final question. How does the Antarctic rate in your life?
Oh, massive, massive. Not understood at the time, it was a jaunt, and it was good to do, and it worked out. Character forming, really learned a lot about myself, as I think every FID did, but myself as a doctor, deficiencies, and you know, some positives, and you know, how to relate to one's fellow man, you know, better. So it was a real character. You were there in a group and you were there on your merit. You know, you couldn't fall back on I'm a doctor and therefore do as I say. You know, you were sussed out. Everybody was sussed out on their merits, and if you weren't up to it in whatever sphere you were, you had a worse time than somebody who was competent. How to deal with the quiet people, and appreciate them, and more importantly, perhaps how to deal with the loud mouth of those who are vexatious in spirit, as they say, because you get all those spectrum and the rest of it, and you learn a lot about how to deal with it and how you react, your own strengths and weaknesses.
So it changed you, did it?
Oh yeah. Oh yes, I think it developed me quite a lot, and for that I've been very grateful. So I owe Bass a huge amount, really. And although I've not been one who's really, if you like, never moved on from Bass. I mean, some people, you get the impression that they continue to live it all the time, and there's, you know, it's still a major feature of their life. I look back upon it as a very important area, a time of development of my rounding as a doctor. And I brought a lot of those skills to, I think, to my approach to clinical medicine over many years. And, I think it's helped me to help my patients and the people I work with. How to lead, leadership, that is the big thing. I know it's the buzzword, but... You know, you learn, if you want to get something done. I mean, I talked to you about the business of that research and, you know, imposing, not imposing, but asking people to do some quite unpleasant things. And you sort of learned by watching others what worked and what didn't. And it sounds a bit sort of exploitative. It's not meant to be, but you learned how to, how you want to be treated. To follow, and what you had to do to be a successful leader. And I've done quite a bit of that in the hospital over the years since then, and I think the Antarctic definitely helped me there.
And when you stepped back onto the medical conveyor belt in the mid-70s and presented your CV with this slightly irregular entry, was that a benefit you hoped it would be?
Immediately, no, I couldn't quite understand how the world didn't beat a path to my surgical door and say, fantastic, come in and have a training. No, it was all a bit difficult, and you sort of think, have I made a horrible mistake? But I got a lead, an opening, to go on to the training scheme at Adam Brooks in Cambridge, did the locum, and then they obviously thought I was all right and took me on, and I never looked back really from that. Just so lucky. And then, ever since then, every job or whatever, people look at your CV and they say, oh, you're in the Antarctic. And they want to know about it and talk to you about it. And there was an MD at the end of it. Mm. So hugely advantageous. And I say to the trainees, because I was heavily involved in training locally and at national level for, you know, a large part of my career. And the trainees, as you were saying earlier on, have been encouraged to get onto a conveyor belt. This is the government's view of how you produce doctors. It's simplistic. It's sort of sausage manufacturing type of view. And the colleges at various times have actually been complicit in supporting that view. Mm-hmm. And I've been the voice, one of the voices, the few voices, to say this is wrong. If you want rounded doctors, they have to have experience outside of medicine, not just before they go into training, but afterwards, so that they, even if they go to America, even if they go and work as missionaries, even if they go and do expedition medicine, climb a mountain or sail across the, do something that's different, and you interact with your fellow man on a more base level, and learn about people, and you bring that back to your doctoring after that. And I feel very passionate about that. So, contrary to the advice that was being offered 5 or 10 years ago with the upheaval in medical training, when trainees came to me for advice, I would say to them, forget about it. If you're going to do something different, and people will look at that and they will pick it out, and your CV will stand out from the other 25 who've done nothing but just, you know, steady, bare minimum. But if you've done something different and you can show you've benefited from that, fantastic. And a few of them have followed that advice and have done all right, you know, I think.
It's been a real pleasure, Dennis. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for asking me. Thank you. Good fun.